Case number 22-5238, et al. Maine Lobster Man's Association, appellant, State of Maine Department of Marine Resources, et al. Versus National Marine Fisheries Service, et al. Mr. Clement for the appellant, Maine Lobster Man's Association. Ms. Engels for the appellee, National Marine Fisheries Service, et al. Ms. Monsell for the intervener appellee, Conservation Groups.
Mr. Clement, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Paul Clement for the appellants. Properly construed, the Endangered Species Act does not require the federal government to shutter an iconic industry central to the cultural identity of Maine to avoid speculative harms to an endangered species. The federal government approach of protecting species against worst-case scenarios without considering the countervailing costs for other important objectives harkens back to the pre-TVA Hill approach to the Endangered Species Act that Congress amended the ESA to address. And as amended, the ESA requires the federal government to consider likely scenarios and make decisions based on the best available scientific and commercial data, not based on speculation, presumptions, and worst-case scenarios.
Could the reviewing agency adopt a tie goes to the species rule?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason I don't think they could adopt that rule properly is because if you adopt that kind of substantive presumption that the tie goes to the species, then I'm afraid the agency is going to find ties everywhere. I mean, I really think what the statute tells them to do is to take the best available scientific and commercial data and take it where it leads. And I think anything that puts a thumb on the scale or considers worst case scenarios or even breaks ties is going to take them away from the mission that Congress gave them with that direction to use the best available scientific and commercial data. And I think in a sense, this biological opinion is an example of why what seems like it might sound reasonable, which is, everything you can. And then, at the last stage, kind of like Chevron, exhausted every other statutory tool in the toolbox, and then only then
it's like Chevron or lenity or any doctrine like that, where you shouldn't get to the tie too quickly. But gosh, I don't know. I mean, isn't this a question of degree? I mean, this opinion sounds a little extreme because of the extent the thumb.
Right.
But I don't know why. I mean, if it really were a 50-50 question, it might be 100, it might be 80, and they say 80 is better for the species. It doesn't seem unreasonable.
Here's the reason, even if it seems reasonable, it's not consistent with the statute, and here's why ultimately it's not even reasonable, which is the way this works in practice is this is not like there's one datum and you just have to make a judgment based on that one datum. This is like a formula that considers multiple factors and factors after factors. So if in every stage of the process, as is the case here, you break the tie in favor of the species, then when you multiply all of those tie-breaking results, you end up with a biological opinion like this, where the agency itself says this is likely to radically, they didn't say radically, but they admit that it's likely to overestimate the impact, that's going to have in on the species. And so I think that's why what sounds innocuous in theory is not innocuous in practice, and it creates the distortions that you see here. And it's not consistent with the statutory text. It's not consistent with the regulatory text. I mean, one of the reasons why I don't think the agency has expressly asked for Chevron deference here is they have a bigger problem under the regulations than they do under the statutory language, because the statutory language talks about what's likely. The regulatory language talks about what's reasonably certain, that they are supposed to be taking into account things that are reasonably certain. And that's an even bigger problem.
Well, Mr. Clement, suppose there's just no data at one of these stages in the analysis. Let's say there's just no data on mortality in Canada.
None. Right.
What are they supposed to do?
I think at that point, they are supposed to do the best job they can based on the available scientific and commercially available data.
Let's stay with this example. There are no data on mortality in Canada. It defies common sense to think that no whale ever died in Canada.
Right.
Country would be overrun with whales if that had. So what are they to do?
So they're to take.
They got to do something.
Sure. And what they have to do, in my view, is they have to take whatever data they have. So they have no data in Canada. I'm kicking your assumption. There's no data from Canada, but they have some data from the United States. So then they take the data from the United States and they make reasonable assumptions about what would be different in Canada. And, you know, if they have some additional survey that says, well, when the water gets 10 degrees cooler, then something different happens, they can take that into account. But they got to take it.
Drop the data from the U.S. They have no data on either side. But there are conditions that differ from one place to the other, but no data.
Well, I think if there's no data at all, I would say that there's nothing that's particularly likely, nothing that's reasonably certain. But I think in every practical situation that arises, there's going to be some data somewhere that they can extrapolate from. But there's a big difference if you extrapolate with a thumb on the scale and if you just extrapolate in your sort of best effort to get to the right result. And if I could just try to give you a concrete example of kind of where this infected the analysis. If you have the joint appendix on page 814, this is page 216 of the biological opinion. And if you keep in mind that the whole reason we're here is because of the unusual mortality event in 2017, because the lobster fishery is authorized up to this point under restrictions that are things that the lobster industry can accommodate. The lobster industry is not interested in harming the right whale. They've taken a lot of efforts, including ones that are economically counterproductive, to get themselves in a position where they're compliant with the prior regime. So what gets us here and causes the agencies to reconsider things and perhaps impose new restrictions is the mortality events in 2017.
What page were you at?
I'm at page 814 of the joint appendix, page 216 of the biological opinion.
Thank you.
And there is this chart, which I think helpfully illustrates kind of who's responsible for the event of why we're here, which I'm not suggesting that's the sum total of the analysis. But when you're trying to make a likely judgment about real world scenarios, if you look at this chart and it's talking about the confirmed entanglements and the ones that have led to fatalities, if you look at the confirmed U.S. column, it is essentially a straight line from 2010 to 2018, and there's about one a year. And in the years 2017 and 2018, which, you know, 2016 to 2018, which might be the most relevant years for the unusual mortality event that has us all here and causes us to change the regulatory approach, there's one each year, and none of them involve serious injury or mortality. On the other hand, if you look at the confirmed Canada column, it is clear that they went from 0 to 1 for every year to having a real problem with multiple entanglements every year, as many as 8 in 2017. And, you know, essentially all of the problem that has us here is a problem that is a Canadian problem. But if you look just a little bit further down on that same page in the first paragraph under the column, you will see that what the agency did there is it basically discarded that data because it thought that there was some better data on scarring analysis in a different data set. And then it said, in explaining why it didn't ultimately rest on this data, it said, the approach provides the benefit of the doubt to the species and a more conservative estimate of total right whale entanglements. Well, you bet it does. But it obscures the basic fact here that the unusual mortality event that has us all here today is a phenomenon that the best available scientific and commercial data make pretty clear is happening in Canada because of the snow crab fisheries, and it's because the climate changes and the like have caused the migration patterns to mean that there are more whales coming into contact with vessels and fishery equipment in Canada. And, you know, and so this, to me, that's just like a dramatic illustration that what seems like a relatively innocuous sort of tie-breaking rule ends up in practice causing the agency to simply ignore some of the best available and scientific data. And part of the reason we focus on this, I mean, you know.
Mr. Clement, are these arguments, in your view, going to the reasonableness of what the agency did or going to the fact that the agency acted contrary to law? Because I think it is really important to disentangle which arguments go to which part of that analysis.
Yeah, and thank you, Judge Rao. I was actually just explaining that, you know, that these arguments that I've just been making, I think, do go to the statutory authority and the statutory error. And I was about to explain that, in fact, you know, what I was just showing you is an illustration of one of the manifestations of the error. And my co-appellants have, you know, drilled down at, you know, a level and said some of these things are reasonable. But we made a conscious effort in our brief to focus on what we identified as two overarching errors that we think fundamentally skewed the analysis. And that is the sort of the thumb on the scale, the worst case scenarios instead of the best available scientific data. And what I haven't had a chance to talk about yet, but is also this phenomenon where the consulting agency has effectively pre-baked all of the draconian restrictions just into the proposal.
Before you get to your Q2, just on that point from Judge Rao, is it fair to say that your Q1 framing this as a threshold legal question is sort of the sum total of all of the individual errors, the back-end manifestations of this plus this plus this could make the thing arbitrary, could make the decision arbitrary?
Yes. I mean, what I would say is this happens to be a statutory error at the threshold, essentially, that then manifests itself in a number of errors that you could say are arbitrary.
Even if we wouldn't necessarily find that any one of the decisions on the back end was itself arbitrary.
Yes. I might quibble and say that, you know, at that point, what the APA problem would be was contrary to law as right. opposed to arbitrary and capricious. I think this is, you know, I fully embrace the arguments that the state of Maine and the other interveners have made that this is arbitrary and capricious as a bonus. But I also think it's just contrary to law across the board. And of course, you know, it should surprise nobody that if you deviate from kind of the mission that Congress has given you, you're going to produce results that look arbitrary and capricious as well.
This is all about the biological opinion so far. But as I understand your claim to standing here, it rests on the take reduction, right?
No, we think our claim to standing, we challenge biological opinion, the conservation framework, and the rule.
Okay, well, what provides you with a standing?
All three.
How does the biological opinion bearing injuring you?
It is injuring us because it is effectively conditioning the authorization of the fishery under a view of the Endangered Species Act that necessarily results in draconian restrictions being imposed on us.
Ones that have already been imposed?
Yes, in part.
So you are challenging you would like the existing rule vacated.
Well, I think we would like it sort of invalidated, but not vacated, you know, or remand without fully vacating it.
Why is that?
Because, I think there's at least an argument, and maybe it's different after the intervening Appropriations Act, but, you know, we can't operate the fishery unless we have a biological opinion in place. And so that's why throughout this litigation, we have asked for, you know, a remand without vacature. Because it's, you know, and maybe it's
that,
different.
That seems contradictory. First of all, why doesn't the Appropriation Act give you what you need?
Well, it doesn't give us, I mean, there's two things. One, it may give us what we need in the sense that we may not need a biological opinion in light of the Appropriations Act. But we are still suffering continued injury from the conservation framework.
Oh.
Because, I would actually ask.
The framework is all about things to come, isn't it?
No. And with, I think that's a critical sort of, the conservation framework has four parts. And the first part of it is the rule. And then the second part is a gillnet proposal. And then the third part is something they were planning on doing.
Now the second part they've abandoned, right?
Well, I don't mean to be pedantic, but it's the third part they've abandoned, because there's the second part is with gillnets, and that's not directly affected by.
So the third part.
The third part they said they've abandoned, but here's what they haven't abandoned. They haven't vacated the conservation framework, and their own declaration in support of non-mootness says that they will continue to use the conservation framework for non-regulatory action.
Now, so what does that mean?
Well, I think they are studiously vague, but they do give us some examples. And now I'm reading from the penultimate page of their declaration in support of mootness. This is the Pantone Declaration. And the examples of the non, and I'm literally quoting it, quote, examples of non-regulatory actions described in the conservation framework include providing updates as appropriate on the implementation of the framework to various third parties. I don't know how you say you've abandoned the framework or it's no longer an operative document when you're giving regulated parties updates on the implementation of the framework. And then the next thing they say, and this really gets to the point of continuing injury, and whether you thought this would be sufficient if we were coming in today initially with our challenge is obviously a separate question of whether we suffer the kind of continuing injury that avoids mootness. And on that, they say that they will be updating any available data to assess, and again, I'm quoting, to assess progress towards achieving the conservation framework's goals. Well, the stated goal of the conservation framework in 2030, which is after the appropriations rider sort of pause expires, is to get us down to a take level of 0.136.
You just read, though, was all about things that they're going to do in the future. Right?
It's what they're doing now. They're assessing data on a day-to-day basis,
How does their assessment of the data then today affect you?
It affects us in the sense that there are ongoing meetings in the take reduction team meetings that are all that are mandatory meetings, and they're all being done with an eye towards ensuring there's compliance of the fishery with both the ESA and the Marine Mammal Protection
Act. And doesn't the act give you that, the Appropriations Act? It is in compliance.
We're in compliance until 2028, but we still have to have ongoing meetings, and we have to figure out what's going to happen in 2029 and 2030. And they are telling us that right now they are evaluating the current data in light of the goals in the conservation framework, which for 2030 are a wholly unrealistic 1.36, and their goal is based on all of this bad science and all of this bad data. To be clear, that's all, to me, fully sufficient to satisfy the standard for continuing effect to avoid mootness. And, the West Virginia EPA case obviously speaks directly to that. But we're also suffering injury right now from the rule.
There's no doubt in my mind, you have a live challenge to phase one, the rule. And based on that challenge, we can look at the biological opinion to the extent it supports them.
Right.
But I guess I'm a lot more skeptical about, I had thought the framework consists of the rule, which fine, you have your challenge, and then phases 3 and 4, which are pie in the sky, might happen in the future, and Congress has now said aren't going to happen. You're in compliance with phase 3 and 4.
I would urge you to take another look at our declarations for the expedition motion. Now, obviously, they weren't, written with an eye towards the intervening congressional act, but they were, they made clear that, the industry, as one would expect, they have to today try to make investments to decide whether to buy another boat, buy more traps, all with an eye towards what's the regulatory environment going forward. And what the declaration shows you is to a moral certainty that the agency is sticking by its guns and the goals as set up in the biological opinion in the conservation framework. And we, like, we just can't ignore.
We don't know how that's going to manifest itself in future regulations. It seems like a pretty bad prudential ripeness problem if we're going to try to guess, not at phase one, which is on the books harming you, and we look at that, but future agency action.
So I don't, you know, I, it's not my burden to convince you that I win this case the hard way and the easy way. And you've already told me that you think that, you know, that
I mean, I've told you they're different actions under review, and we have a clean shot at one of them, but I'm skeptical about the rest of it.
Well, then let me address your skepticism head on, because the question here is not what, like, I just don't think you get to prudential rightness the way you would if we walk into court today and said, I'm going to show you I have Article 3 standing to challenge the biological opinion and the conservation framework. The question that is relevant for mootness, and again, the other cases, late law, other cases that we cite in our opposition make this clear, but I also think, you know, since the West Virginia case is recent and on a lot of people's minds, you know, it makes this very clear that the standard is different when you're at mootness. And the standard, you know, the burden shifts to the government, and the government has to show that there's, you know, no possibility that the injury doesn't linger. And here, not only have they not carried their burden, they've actually essentially put themselves out of that burden by saying they're going to continue to use the biological opinions for non-regulatory action.
Then I guess I have a question. Why are you not seeking vacator of the biological opinion? I mean, if we were to agree with you on the first question, would it be open to us to vacate the biological opinion and not the final rule?
So the short answer is, I think it is debatable, but I think the better view is that after the appropriations rider, if I can call it, it is open to you to vacate the biological opinion.
Why are you not seeking that?
Well, the reason I'm not seeking that is principally a historical artifact of the fact that up until the point that the appropriations rider came into play, so throughout all of the district court proceedings, we affirmatively asked, and every brief we filed in this court up until the mootness response, we were very clear that we were asking for essentially remand without vacature.
Because you needed the biological
opinion. Because we needed the biological opinion to operate the fishery. Right. I think the best reading.
Do you need the opinion to operate the fishery or the final rule? Or are they inextricably connected in a way that you need both in order to operate the fishery?
So I think that the best answer to that is what we absolutely need is the biological opinion. I think the agency in this case has sort of tied them together in a way that's not our fault and really didn't matter at all until the appropriations rider. But, you know, the biological opinion is an evaluation of the conservation framework, the first piece of which is the rule. So in their mootness papers, they try to kind of disentangle them in ways that I just don't think work, given the history of this case. But just to be as clear as I can, for purpose until the appropriations act, it was our considered and I think absolutely correct view that we needed the biological opinion to operate the fishery, so we didn't want to get a vacature of the biological opinion.
Is that still true
yeah. after the act?
I think the better view is no. Which is to say, I think it's not true. I think my reading of the act says that, you know, that sort of we have sort of a sufficient basis to operate and under the final rule. That's sufficient. I don't think it says necessary, which is why I do think, you know, and just to be clear about that and to clear about the sort of continuing injury that we suffer. I mean, you know, as part of our own efforts to try to be responsible and out of our own concerns about the right whale, we don't have a particular objection to a lot of what's in the final rule in terms of gear marking and things that we think will ultimately just make it more obvious that we are not the source of the problem. But one of the things the final rule did kind of threw in as a relatively unanalyzed bonus is to have an offshore closure the whole parts of the Gulf of Maine talk about irreparable injury. You know, my clients can't go there because of that aspect of the rule. And so, you know, I think one way we could get relief here is putting aside for a second exactly how you stylize it, whether it's a, you know, remand without vacature, or it's a vacature of the biological opinion, but only because of the Appropriations Act. But if one of the things that came out of that is that we ended up with the final rule without the offshore closure, that would, you know, have a huge immediate on the ground real world effect that would benefit my client.
Can I ask you also, I have some other questions about the merits of Q2, but as to remedy for your second question about the conservation framework, I mean, if we were to find that the agencies acted ultra vires by imposing the conservation framework in the way that it was imposed, would that be a basis for vacating the conservation framework?
I think it would be. So is the short answer. So yes, I don't overcomplicate it. Yes.
And what is it that you would need in order to re-enter the now off limits zone?
We cannot enter the off limits zone with the current final rule in place. I'd like to say a few words on the merits of QP too, because Judge Rao mentioned she had questions on
We'll let you do that. But if we remand without vacating, that restriction is still in place, no?
It is, but if my sort of understanding is, you know, there are different ways to, you know, sort of remand without vacating. And if there's a remand with a requirement that they do the math over, or a strong suggestion that they modify the rule in order to come into compliance, you know, I think that
they might let you, but our order wouldn't do that.
No, okay. Could vacate the final rule or vacate the final rule in part, I think that just gets, you know, that's again, it's a little bit complicated because the Appropriation Act comes in very late in the litigation, and I don't think it moots anything. But it does, you know, maybe change the battlefield in terms of what precise relief would be most appropriate. I don't want to anticipate an argument my friends would make, but, you know, since they seem to think that, you know, sufficient means necessary, they would probably say, well, you can't vacate the final rule because that's necessary for compliance under the Appropriations Act. That's not how I read it. I read it as sufficient means sufficient. And so, if the agency ultimately came back and said, all right, you know, all you need is we're going to have the final rule without the offshore closure, and that's all that is necessary for compliance with the ESA and the MMPA, we think it would be valid under that, and the statute would provide, essentially in our view, the statute provides a ceiling, but it doesn't provide a floor.
Unless there are other questions on that, why don't you go to the merits of Q2?
Sure. On Q2, you know, I really do think that this is a pretty serious evasion of the basic structure of the ESA and how it's supposed to work, which is, I think, the way that the Act is supposed to work and consistent with the amendments. And virtually all the provisions we're talking about here were amended after TVA against Hill to prevent sort of a replication of Yasapa Teleco Dam in a way that doesn't make economic sense to most people who are observing it. And so these provisions are basically designed to ensure that there's a place where you take into account the countervailing effects of the action, even in a case where there's some jeopardy or some incidental take. And if you allow the consulting agency, not the action agency, though I don't think the action agency can do it either, but if you allow the consultant agency here, as is conceded to be the case, to sort of come in and essentially say on the front end, look, before you even run this through the process, that is supposed to get you to cost-benefit analysis to a degree, you got to impose all these draconian restrictions on the fishery, and then we'll run that through the process, and we'll get a no jeopardy finding, and we'll even not make an incidental take finding, which of course gets complicated because that gets challenged by my friends on the other side below as, you know, as not consistent with either the ESA or the MMPA.
The question I have about this is, even if we accept your argument that what they did here is in you know, is in real tension with the ESA and the way it's supposed to work with action agencies and the consulting agencies. Surely under the ESA, there's some informal consultation that goes on, right, between action agencies and the consulting services. So where would we draw a line between, you know, what might be a legitimate kind of back and forth that seems to be envisioned by the statute and the regulations and a situation such as this, where you are saying, you know, they've gone really too far in imposing these regulatory requirements?
So two things, Your Honor. One is, I think the bright line rule at a minimum is the consulting agency can't do it. If the action agency wants to sort of, you know, kind of talk to the consultant agency informally and then make their formal proposal, that seems to me different from a situation like this where, you know, essentially the proposal that gets considered by the consulting agency is really the product of the consulting agency. So that's one just, I think, clear benchmark. But I also think that this.
Is that really the benchmark if the action agency is sort of coerced into doing that or just sort of adopts it wholesale? Like it can't just be I'm not sure if that is a distinction that would necessarily make the action more lawful.
Well, I would say that's something that's clearly ultra virus, but I would also say that to the extent you're envisioning a circumstance where the action agency is essentially coerced into it, then that would also be a violation of the statutory structure and contrary to law. And I think this court should make clear the agencies are supposed to deal with the ESA issues through consultation. And the consultation involves what the agency actually wants to do. And then the consulting agency brings to bear its expertise as to whether that's consistent with the act in a way that ultimately does two critical things in my view. One, it brings cost benefit analysis to bear in a direct way. But second, it doesn't cut the committee out of the process entirely.
I wonder, though, whether the action agency itself has the statutory authority to adopt the conservation framework, right? Because the underlying action here is the approval of the fishery, under these fishery management plans and the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Is there anything in those statutes that gives the action agency even the lawful authority to impose the conservation framework?
We don't think so.
You focused on in your briefing, but I think there are two questions. There's a question about whether the consulting agency can impose these requirements. You make a number of arguments why they cannot under the statute. But I have a question about whether even the action agency here could impose that under the because the action that's at stake is approval of the fisheries and the statutes are actually very detailed about what factors they're allowed to consider in that process, and none of those factors involve endangered species concerns.
So what I would say, Judge Rao, is I have an answer at the podium for you, which is I don't think that the action agency has the authority to do that. I also have a defense for why we didn't brief that. And the defense why we didn't brief that is because the parties agree that it was a consultation agency that did it here. And that seems to me to be kind of one clear problem. But there is a lurking problem. If you really want us to, I'd be happy to brief it. But, you know, the reason we didn't brief it is because it really isn't presented in this particular case. But I agree with you.
The agency does make some arguments that it wasn't the consulting agency that adopted it. I know you disagree with that, but they do seem to make some arguments in that direction.
Well, that's not how I read their brief. In all candor, maybe they will. They certainly argue that it is. There's a symbiotic relationship or there's back and forth. But I took them to concede and not defend Judge Boasberg's rationale. Judge Boasberg's clear rationale was, that this was the action agency and they can do it. And we, in our opening brief, said he's just wrong about that. It was a consulting agency. And I took their responsive brief to essentially not defend Judge Boasberg's reasoning on that point and concede it. And the only other thing I'd say about this is, because, you know, I would imagine that my friends on the other side are going to come up here and they're going to say, well, you know, either something detailed about the fisheries compact that governs the fishery, or they're going to say something about the beginning of the Endangered Species Act that sort of says that every agency has some responsibility to avoid problems under the ESA. But what I would say is you got to read, you know, I would say that it is ultra-virus, and you should read the authority under the organic statute of all the agencies in light of the ESA. And, you know, it is a problem if an action agency takes it on itself to kind of trim its sails because of the ESA and not because of anything that has to do with their organic responsibilities, then it does tend to circumvent the structure of the act. And in particular, it tends to circumvent the Endangered Species Committee, because the act envisions a scenario for how to deal with situations where there's just no good way to avoid jeopardy. And that's the committee. And just to finish this last thought, like, it's kind of really powerful evidence that they evaded the politically responsible committee here, that Congress had to intervene.
Let me go back to Judge Rao's opening point about, I think, maybe inevitable informality in the exchange between the two peer divisions of the same agency. So the action agency comes in with a proposal, and the consulting agency says, look, I can look at this and tell you on its face it's not going to pass, right? Why don't you just redraw it? Or we'll redraw it. I mean, there's no point in me putting this through the process. It's going to fail. That somehow evades the procedure?
I don't think if that's all that happens, I don't think that evades the procedure. And
right, so then the action agency says, well, look, what do you think is necessary? But can you give us a hand with this? What should we build in?
And if it becomes, I mean, you know, this is why the questions are in a sense related. But, you know, I mean, part of the problem is if, you know, the way the statute, I think, is envisioned is the action agency is to a degree supposed to be playing offense. And the consulting agency is supposed to be playing defense. And if an informal consultation is great, but if they sort of switch sides, or, you know, it just like the action agency essentially capitulates, then the party that's playing defense has a natural incentive to sort of, you know, look at everything from the perspective of a defense and sort of, you know, even when they're not explicit about it as here, kind of err on the side of the species. And if that, you know, and I think you can write an opinion that says, look, informal consultation is fine, but you can't let the consulting agency get to the point that they're taking over the process, and you, as the action agency, you can't pre-bake things to the point that you're evading the statute.
Well, the action agency could always come back and say, no, we don't want to do that. If it won't fly, it won't fly, but this is our proposal. They didn't say that. I said, instead, give us a hand.
Yeah, I mean, agree.
It seems to me you're asking for a paper shuffle to no purpose.
I don't think so, because I think if you make clear that the action agency is not supposed to sort of pre-bake its defensive crouch into its proposal, then you will have a situation where the statute works as intended. And it may, you know, that my friends on the other side want to say, well, you know, the Endangered Species Committee's only met 6 times. I might say that's, you know, that's a bug, not a feature. Because, you know, if you look at the statutory text, most of the words are describing the Endangered Species Committee. And I think Congress amending the statute in light of TVA against Hill expected the Endangered Species Committee to be convened more than 6 times in the next, you know, what has it been, 45 years or whatever? And I think that, again, I just point you, you know, the forces that caused Congress, which, you know, takes a lot to get over the inertia to intervene here, is the fact that you've finally got politically responsible people to take a look at this and say, we all appreciate the right whale. We all want to do the right thing by the right whale, but fun's fun. And you don't just take out an entire industry, especially when all signs point to the real problem lying north of the border. And the Canadians, to be clear, are being responsible and trying to do their level best to deal with it too. But my point is, you know, Senator Collins, you know, identified this as the greatest regulatory overreach that she has seen. I think, you know, part of that is some of the things that we pointed to in our briefs and some of the problems that infected this. But part of it is that the statute was designed to, you know, when if there really is a case, and I'm sure my friends on the other side think this, where if you just kind of continue business as usual, jeopardy is just unavoidable. Like, the statute has a fix for that, at least as to the ESA. It's a little complicated because the MMPA may be a little distinct in this regard, but at least as to the ESA, which is the focal point of the biological opinion, that's the safety valve for the politically accountable process to be brought to bear.
The action agency can go on offense, push as hard as they want to do whatever they want, be adversarial with the reviewing agency, and their ultimate trump card is to go to that committee. But they don't have to take that posture, right? They can choose to adopt a more conservative, species-friendly action, right?
Maybe not. And this is the ultra-virus point that Judge Rao and I were discussing. I think there's a good argument.
Put aside the point about whether there's something in the fishing statutes that would make them authorized. I'm just talking about the dynamic between the action agency and the reviewing agency.
Right.
And it seems to me what's going on here is the reviewing agency has something akin to a veto power on the back end of a process. And they are leveraging that to try to influence what happens on the front end. But I mean, so what? You know, the president has a veto power with respect to legislation. He says to Congress about a pending bill, don't even think about putting this on my desk. I will veto it, but I will sign a bill, a rewritten bill with the following features. And Congress thinks we're really coerced. We won't be able to override the veto. We'll change the bill, pass what the president wants, and he signs it. The president is not acting ultra-virus vis-a-vis Article 1.
I agree with that. Okay. Let me say two things that are different here. First, the clear bright line rule. Whatever else is true, the action agency that's supposed to play offense, even if they want to trim their sails on their own, then there's a question that Judge Rao and I were discussing about whether that's consistent with their organic statute. But at a minimum, they can't hand the keys over to the defense. And that's what happens.
Well, that's what I'm pushing on. I'm not sure why not.
Well,
the reviewing agency can exert as much pressure as they want, and the action agency can either pull back and defensively, or they can fight them. They say, no, we want to authorize the fishery, no condition. You go ahead and say there's no reasonably prudent alternative, and we'll fight you before the committee. That's their choice.
Just two points, Your Honor. One is that even, again, like the one thing they can say, yeah, they can hear that they're pushing back, they can do all that, but in the same way that Congress can't just say to the president who threatens the veto power, all right, you just write the legislation, and we're not even going to go through bicameralism presentment ourselves. It just you write the legislation, and it becomes law. And so that's why it is important to keep the people in their lanes. But here's the second thing. This is not a direct analog to sort of the Constitution in Article 1 and Article 2 and Article 3, because here the consulting agency has a veto subject to a veto. And that's the way the statute was designed. And if the action agency just goes, paws up every time, just because they view the consulting agency as having the ultimate veto, that's inconsistent with the statutory structure. Because it cuts out. And look, I was a believer.
No, because it doesn't eliminate the option of the action agency to push as hard as they want and fight the reviewing agency before the ultimate authority, which is the politically accountable ESA review committee.
With all due respect, if the action agency was explicit and they said, okay, we are going to impose all these draconian restrictions that we don't want because we just want to get the consulting agency to approve, and they were absolutely explicit about that, I would say that is contrary to law. That is not valid government action. Now, I think what a lot of these questions are going to is the idea that, you know, once you write your opinion, no agency's going to be stupid enough to say it out loud that way. But I still think that there is virtue to signaling that if it were explicit, that is not a proper interpretation of the statute, because it does cut out the committee and it's not functioning. Like, I'm as big a, you know, I'm a bigger believer as a unitary executive as the next guy, but this statute does give different responsibilities to different agencies. And if the one agency basically says, like, we're going to admit that we're not doing our job, or we're essentially going to essentially do their job for them on the front end, it does circumvent the statute. It circumvents the cost-benefit analysis. It's supposed to happen on the back end. And it essentially makes the Endangered Species Committee a nullity, even though, again, if you just look at the statute, you can't look at that statute and say Congress wanted that Endangered Species Committee to just be the sword of Damocles. I mean, it's most of the relevant statutory language that was added after TVA against Hill. It goes through all the details of how that committee works and the circumstances where Secretary of State can override the committee if there's a treaty violation, and then the national defense people can override the Secretary of State if there's a, I mean, so like, you know, there is.
Let me give you one more, and it's probably the same hypo as legislation, but give you a sense where I'm coming from, which is nominations and advice and consent. Right? Senate is on the back end. They can't make nomination. All they can do is veto the president's nomination, right? Let's say we are very late in a presidential term and there's a Supreme Court vacancy, and the Senate says to the president, you know, if you want a nominee, you must pick candidate X, in which case we will move heaven and earth to confirm the nominee, but nobody else. And president says okay, and nominates that candidate, and then they confirm him.
So, same basic. I mean,
very coercive.
Very coercive.
But not an abuse of the back end veto power to try to leverage what happens on the front end.
Same two answers, which is to say, one, even conceding all of that, the Senate can't just appoint the Supreme. The president can't say, all right, you guys, you know, you're holding the cards here, so you disappoint them. I, like, forget it. You're taking all the fun out of this for me. So you just go appoint the person and you confirm them and take me out of the process entirely, because that's what you're trying to do. That would obviously be ultra-virus. But here's the second thing. The second part of the same answer is, if you imagine a world where, it, you know, the system works the way it is, but if there's, like, you know, 40 votes against the nominee or something, that then it goes to the House, and then the House gets to do it. If the Senate were trying to twist the president's arm in a way that was trying to cut the House out of the process, I would think that you'd say there's something problematic about that. And maybe it would be hard to police, but you'd at least want to say, as a matter of what is sort of legal and appropriate, that the Senate can't avowedly say we're doing something to cut out the House out of the process.
And same answer on my side, which is, if the president goes for his home run pick rather than compromise pick with the Senate, he can tee that up for the House.
And my same answer to your same answer, okay, which is, if he says in his nomination speech, I'm doing this to cut the House out of the process, putting aside QQD and all that kind of stuff, that would seem problematic to me.
I think these hypotheticals highlight why it's important whether the action agency has the authority at all. And Judge Katsas's hypotheticals, the president is still acting within his lawful authority, right, to nominate or to veto legislation. But, you know, I mean, if he didn't have that authority at all and the Congress was asking him to do something he didn't have the authority to do, that would make the problem worse. I do think that's a distinction.
The only thing I would say is, I think that even when you're trying to figure out whether the action agency has the authority on the front end, you would read whatever their authority otherwise was in light of the various other parts of the process. And if there was some ambiguous authority that the agency was saying, oh, this gives us the authority to do it all on the front end, I would say the structure of the statute gives you a reason to construe that narrowly to make it kind of harmonious with the ESA. But I see my time is up. So thank you.
Anything else, Judge Rao?
No, thank you.
Did you just notice that?
Just now. It's great.
We don't always enforce the red light. Thank you. Ms. Engels, we'll hear from you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Summer Engels, here for the federal appellees. With me at council table for the intervenors appellees is Kristen Monsell. The federal appellees ask the court to dismiss this appeal as moot or otherwise to affirm on the merits. And I'd like to begin.
How is the challenge to phase one, the final rule, moot? The rule is in effect. It imposes tangible economic harm on the regulated industry, and they're here through their trade representative.
Understood. Well, our argument as to the rule is that the act has overtaken any challenge plaintiffs might have asserted as to the rule. We maintain that the challenge is forfeited on appeal. But the act says that the rule is sufficient to put authorization of the fisheries in full compliance with the MMPA and the ESA. And we read that to imply that if the rule is sufficient to put these fisheries in compliance with these two statutes, then the rule could not possibly be inconsistent with those two statutes itself. And so
that's a merits argument.
It's a merits argument in the sense that the Congress has said that the rule complies with the merits. But for present purposes, our argument is that Congress has acted and removed any ability to put forward a judgment as to the merits of the rule. The Congress has deemed the rule sufficient to put these fisheries in compliance, and therefore, by implication, has said that the rule itself complies with the ESA. Taking a broader view of the statute.
Can I just one question on that? Is whether it's merits or mootness, why would you read sufficient to mean necessary?
Conceitedly, generally, sufficient does not mean necessary, but here we think it does. And that brings me to my second point. The rule in the act that Congress has promulgated here is the operative element. It's the linchpin of Congress's determination that the authorization is in full compliance. So it must remain. If the rule were to be remanded and the agency were to be tasked with preparing some different rule, there would be no way to say whether continued authorization of the fisheries is still in compliance with those two relevant statutes. And although I realize that a FLIR statement is only light support, Angus King said when he introduced this that the provision was a compromise negotiated between various people interested in this issue in the body that leaves in place all of those protective measures. And when he said protective measures, he was referring to the rule. So whether it's couched in mootness or a directed result, the point is that the act has overtaken any challenge the plaintiffs might have asserted as to the merits of the rule.
Let me just ask you to clarify something. I'm not sure I got that. You're saying once the statute is passed, deeming the rule sufficient, it precludes a challenge on the merits because that, if successful, would leave no one would know whether they're in compliance. Is that what you were saying?
The argument is yes. The statute does say sufficient, but if the rule were to be remanded for promulgation of something less stringent, perhaps,
right,
we would be essentially left without the legislation. There's no way to know whether the authorization would be in full compliance if the rule has been taken out of the method. That's why I say that the rule is the linchpin or the keystone of.
Okay, well, there wouldn't be a way to know except through litigation. That can be resolved. If the remand results in a certain portion of the rule being invalidated, so the question is, well, is it still sufficient? The agency, the government can take a view on that, say, well, it's not anymore sufficient, and precipitate a lawsuit.
That is possible, we would certainly be back in court. But I think my broader point is that if we were litigating about whether a new rule complied with the ESA or the MMPA, it would essentially be setting aside what Congress has already said here. We would be back to square one, looking at compliance with the ESA and the MMPA. And when Congress passed this statute, it put a pause in place for the next 6 years and instructed the agency with a significant amount of funding to spend its resources working with other parties, states, regulated parties to generate new technologies that would be incorporated into a new rule in 2018.
Okay, so does it follow from what you're saying then that if the court were to say, we're not going to vacate the rule, it's been deemed sufficient, but we're going to entertain the appellant's claim that parts of the rule are arbitrary in their formation. Basically, they're seeking a declaration to that effect. That would also be precluded?
I think it would be precluded by the language of the Act and the purpose of the statute, which was to put a pause here. But to pivot slightly, if plaintiff's argument is that the rule is invalid because it relies on the biological opinion, they're foreclosed again because, as we've explained, the authorization of the fisheries after the rule is in full compliance with the Endangered Species Act. The relevant analysis for compliance with the Endangered Species Act is the biological opinion. And so we disagree with plaintiff's assertion that the rule relies on the biop. That's factually incorrect. But if we were to accept that premise, it would still fail under the language of the statute.
Well, let's assume for the moment that the Appropriations Act makes the rule impregnable. And the appellants tell us, well, that's beside the point. There's an ongoing process which is burdening us based on the biological opinion.
I am struggling to think what that might possibly be. I'm not to be facetious, but they can identify no regulatory actions coming from the biological opinion.
Well, they talked about being engaged in mandatory meetings about achieving the necessary take reduction, and meanwhile suffering under the uncertainty about whether what their members are going to do about investment in terms of new equipment and so on.
Yes, but those actions, the meetings come from the process that is associated with promulgation of a new rule. It's not supposed to be burdensome. It enables them to provide their views to the regulated agency. And that process comes not from the biological opinion, it comes from the Marine Mammal Protection Act. But for present purposes, this no jeopardy biological opinion has no regulatory effect. It has no harm on the plaintiffs. And they've challenged it in this case because they've asserted that the conservation framework somehow sprung from the biological opinion. But as we've explained in our declaration, the conservation framework, or the phases that remain, phases 3 and 4, the phases that affect the relevant fisheries, are not being pursued. We make this very clear in the declarations. Service says, in light of
phases 3 and 4.
Correct.
But the biological opinion is the entire basis for phase 1. Biological opinion said, here are the 4 things we need to do
respectfully
in order to attain compliance.
I respectfully disagree. The phase 1 rule was promulgated, as we've explained in our brief on pages 10 through 16, it's promulgated under the MMPA, Marine Mammal Protection Act process. And that process was ongoing. It was initiated in 2017, and it's a separate regulatory process. So it had its own Endangered Species Act consultation. That's at pages A378 through 79 of the biop, of the record. So this process was ongoing. It's entirely separate from the consultation that was associated, or the consultation undertaken to evaluate whether the continued authorization of the fisheries would likely jeopardize the species. And so, yes, biological opinion does reference phase 1, the conservation framework, but that's the take reduction plan amendment rule. It was already in place, or the production of that rule was in place. It's not relying on the biological opinion. The biological opinion might be dependent on phase one in the sense that it analyzed the fisheries as they would proceed under that rule. But phase one is not dependent on the biological opinion.
Your defense of the rule in your briefing seems to rest entirely on the biological opinion and not on some independent ground through MMPA process.
We haven't advanced a specific argument in our rule as or in our briefing as to the rule because we didn't see that they had made a separate argument specific to the rule.
A challenge to the rule?
Correct.
Count three of their complaint challenges phase one based on perceived flaws in the biological opinion. And Judge Boasberg's opinion saw it exactly that way. He said the biological opinion is fine, and therefore the phase one rule that flows from the biological opinion is fine. So that's the way the issue was teed up.
I confess that our brief could have been more specific in our explanation of the separate regulatory processes for these two actions. But again, at pages 10 through 16 of our brief, we explain that they are indeed separate. And I'm happy to proceed to our discussions about the validity of the biop. But again, the validity of the biop doesn't affect the validity of the rule.
Ms. Engels, can you give us your best statutory argument for why the rule and the biological opinion are not contrary to law, answering the contrary to law argument that appellants have made here? Because most of the briefing really focuses on arbitrary and capricious in defending the actions as reasonable.
Correct, because we the contrary to law argument that plaintiffs have presented, the idea that the biological opinion is somehow inconsistent with Section 7, completely attacks the straw man, which is really not what the agency produced. I'm not able to defend whether it would have been lawful for the agency to set aside the best available science and proceed based on a policy, because that's not what the agency did here. The relevant language in Section 7 is the best available science, and the standard means that the agency needs to evaluate the science and data before it, can't ignore superior data, and must explain its approach, and that's exactly what the agency did here.
What about giving the benefit of the doubt to the species here? I mean, how is that consistent with the statute, and also how is that consistent with the 2019 rule that specifically takes that off of the table?
So I'd like to to answer the question about consistency with the statute was promulgated to conserve threatened species, and it's established a national policy that agencies should seek to conserve listed species. But again, I'm not defending any agency decision to adopt a policy that forced it to ignore the best available science in favor of some sort of freestanding presumption, because that's not what the agency did here. Plaintiffs have selected a number of selective quotes from the record where the agency did say, when we're dealing with data uncertainties, we used metrics representing the worst case scenario. But for example, in that very same context, I'm here speaking about pages A, 926 through 27 of the record. The agency's analysis could stand on its own without any reference to worst case scenario or benefit of the doubt. The agency said in that context that when it was preparing the population projection model, when it was dealing with data uncertainties, for example, uncertainties in the calving rates that might be in the future, or unquantified benefits from conservation measures, it used the actual data. And to bring that down to more granularity, the agency explained that it used calving rates from 29, 2010 to 2019, because that was the actual data it had. And it explained that might actually represent the worst case scenario because calving rates are expected to improve with the framework in place. Likewise, the agency didn't use unquantified benefits from conservation measures in Canada because they couldn't be quantified.
But the agency said when the data produce a range, we will pick, when in selecting within the range, we pick the best for the species. And that seems, I mean, that's not a tiebreaker rule. And that's not a thumb on the scale. That's a whole arm on the scale.
There were some cases where the agency, when faced with uncertainty or a range of particular values or different analytical approaches, when those could all be applied to the same data set, reasonably, yes, the agency proceeded with caution. That is entirely consistent with the Endangered Species Act.
Well, how is it, Ms. Engels, you're avoiding my question about how that's consistent with the 2019 regulation that my understanding is still on the books, right? So there's a 2019 regulation that says in this process that agencies are not to use the worst case scenario or make conservative modeling assumptions. It specifically rejects the benefit of the DAP theory, and it finds irrelevant the conference report that is relied on in your brief. So how is all of that consistent with the regulation that is still on the books from just a few years ago?
So if Your Honor is referring to 84 Fed Reg pages 44, 976 and 45,000, those are comments that the agency provided, or responses to comments that the agency provided when it promulgated that regulation. But ultimately it said, the agency, yes, it's the Endangered Species Act. We are concerned about listed species, but the agency is not under an obligation to adopt the worst case scenario. It's obligated to apply the best available science. And it explained that could be data, agency knowledge, expertise. And it confirmed that the agency needs to consider actions and effects that are reasonably certain to occur. But that's exactly what the agency did here. It was relying on data, and it didn't apply that approach in every instance. So, for example, on page A817 of the appendix, that's where the agency explained how it was going to allocate deaths that couldn't clearly be attributed to either entanglement or boat strikes. And it said that based on the observed data, it would allocate 77% of the mortalities of unknown cause to entanglement, because in that instance, the observed data was representative. But there was a study from 2021, the PACE study, referenced on that same page, that said there would have been a reason to allocate 87% of these unknown mortalities to entanglement. And the agency didn't proceed with that figure because it understood that the data it had that supported 77% was the best available data. So the best reading of this record is that the agency did apply the best available data. It did not displace that data with some policy or presumption. Did it reference the worst case scenario or be applying a conservative approach? Yes. But if those parts were struck from the record, the rest of the analysis would stand on its own. And I note here that the caution is consistent with the Endangered Species Act, and is also reflective of the fact that the agency was assessing possible jeopardy to a species with only fewer than 350 individuals remaining. So in any case where it makes sense to proceed with caution or apply a conservative approach, it made sense to do so here. But that analysis, the agency's data analysis, was not driven by the status of the species. It was driven by the data and the science, and that's supported by.
So when it says at 506, the assumptions may be considered pessimistic, but we need to give the benefit of the doubt to the species. We're supposed to disregard that?
I think in that context, the agency was talking about population projections and explaining that all of the analysis that it conducted along the way might yield a result that looked like it would be send the whale on a sharper trajectory than would actually possibly play out in reality.
You said that the agency doesn't really believe its own projections. We utilized metrics representing the worst case scenario. Consequently, model outputs very likely overestimate the likelihood of a declining population.
Yes.
That sounds driven much more by the presumption than by the data.
Respectfully, the better way to view that, we submit, is that when the agency was looking at ranges of values for the analysis and picked from those the figures that were more conservative but still supported by the data, the aggregation resulted in a more pessimistic population trajectory. But ultimately, the agency reached a no jeopardy conclusion. It wasn't producing the population trajectory figures because they had a specific regulatory effect or because it was looking for precision in the next 50 years. It was looking only to determine whether continued authorization of the fisheries would jeopardize the whale. And it determined, based on its analysis, that it would not.
If the agency were trying to measure something relevant to this and they get probability distribution, some variable, did they say, we're not going to pick the height of the bell curve. We're going to go 2 standard deviations to the left because that point is more protective of the species?
I think it would have to be a fact-specific analysis. I mean, I understand we're talking about statistics. And if the best data shows the center line is the right approach, then that would be what the agency has to do. It has to justify its determination. And can't say
they have to take their best shot at coming up with the best answer. Can't just say, oh, there's this broad range, so we're going to pick the endpoint rather than something in the heartland.
It couldn't do it in every case. It has to be justified based on the record. But again, that is what the agency did here. And there are places in the record where the agency referred to using a worst case scenario. But in all of the instances, the agency explained its approach and why it was based on the data. Ultimately, the best available science standard means that the agency can't base its decision on speculation. That's not what the agency did here. And plaintiffs identify no better information that the agency overlooked. And so the story about a broad policy is really an attack on the straw man that doesn't have support in the record.
The agency's charge is to figure out what's likely. Is that not right? The word likely is key here?
It is.
So that makes it difficult for me to understand some things that appear in the brief. And this is an example along the lines you've been discussing. The service evaluated a worst case scenario among the most likely scenarios. What does that mean?
Well, our point is simply that a true worst case scenario would have allocated all entanglements to U.S. fisheries and said, that it would happen in great numbers, great far into the future. That would be a true worst case scenario. What the agency did here was evaluate the available data, assess its confidence in that data, and say, when there are a number of equally likely or possible outcomes, we will take the one that is more conservative or more cautious, because our task is to ensure that jeopardy is unlikely, and selecting an outcome that might understate the effects would not be consistent with that mandate.
Likely just means more, 51%, right? More than 50%.
Yes.
So if you have a worst case scenario that is truly worst case scenario, where it's extremely unlikely that the species will survive, and several other intermediate steps, you're saying, well, that's just too unlikely. We're not gonna. But the one that says, well, there's a 60% chance that the species will survive, and another one that says there's a 40% that it will survive, you're going to take the 40%.
It would depend on whether that decision was supported by the data. But for example, here, you know, I turn back to the page A817 where we discussed the difference between entanglements and boat strikes.
What? Give me the page number again.
It was page A817 of the record.
817.
And so in that instance, the agency had one figure that said, based on a 2021 study, that it could allocate 87% of the unknown cause deaths to entanglements. But it also had data that showed that 77% of the unknown causes could be attributed to entanglements. And in that case, because it determined that the 77% figure had more support in the record and was more reliable, it proceeded with that figure. And so it's not true that in every case it said we will pick the most conservative figure.
But that may well be. The problem arises if in any case it did.
I haven't found a place in the record where they did that, and the appellants haven't either.
The 50-50 split on, I guess it's mortalities, right? That's between Canada and the U.S. would seem to be an example.
Well, the agency there explained that although there were more observed entanglements that could be attributed to Canada, most observed data is not representative. Again, the whales move, lots of gear is unmarked. And so the fact that some have been found in Canada is not representative of the larger of the larger circumstance. The surveys that are being conducted in Canada are more carcass detection studies. They support a different mission. And the agency said the whales are spending more time in the United States. Yes, they're spending more time. Some a population is spending more time in Canada. But there are considerations on both sides of the border.
When it said that to some, whatever it is, some degree, the whales are spending time in the United States,
mm-hmm.
did that distinguish at all between the Southeast Ocean off the United States or versus the lobster, the fishery area?
I'm not aware of a figure. I can't
so
say.
So what's the relevance of when they're in the southern waters? I don't see the relevance of their having been in the United States.
I take your point, Your Honor. I think the way I respond is by saying that, yes, although a population is moving into Canada, it's only a small concentration of the population, about one-third, and that concentration still spends about half of its time in the U.S. waters. That's on A480. This was a difficult analysis.
Whatever that half is for U.S. waters should have been discounted to reflect relevant waters.
Perhaps it would have been possible to be more precise in these figures, but this is difficult. The agency is working with very limited data. Their population is limited, and the agency submitted its analysis to independent experts who did express disagreement on the best approach.
Well, I'm not sure that limited data helps here. Could the agency lawfully have said, or not arbitrarily have said, well, obviously, some of the time is spent outside of the fishery areas, indeed, maybe half the year. But we're not sure about how much, so we're just going to disregard that, not try to adjust.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat the question?
Saying I don't understand why the absence of data is the obstacle here to making some adjustment for the fact that the whales who spend half their time in the United States do not spend all of that time in the fishery. Or even in New England.
Understood. And I think with these analyses, they could always be more precise. But the question is whether it was reasonable. And when the agency conferred with independent experts, they expressed disagreement on the best approach, but ultimately determined, and this is page A1992 of the appendix, that the 50-50 split was likely still a conservative estimate of residency in U.S. waters, and there was no data on which to base a different level of apportionment.
Is that the point on which the peer review committee was divided?
Yes, they were divided, but the ultimate conclusion, the agreement, was that there was no better way to draw the line. And so the question for present purposes is not whether the agency could have developed a more precise analysis or whether it might not completely accurately reflect on the ground or in the water circumstances. The question is whether the agency reasonably applied and considered the data before it, and it did that. And therefore, it applied the best available science.
You want to just, do you have anything to say on Mr. Clement's second point?
I'm happy to address it briefly. I think my primary point here is that the The regulatory authority to proceed with the conservation framework and the regulations therein comes from the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The idea that moving forward to a jeopardy determination would somehow have opened up a variety of doors that would have helped the fishery is not accurate. If the agency had reached a jeopardy determination, then the fishery would have had to have shut down. And although the committee procedure does exist, it grants exceptions only when the applicant can show that the action cannot be altered or modified to avoid violating Section A2. And the committee concludes that no reasonable and prudent alternatives are available. And so here, the fact that the agency developed a plan to avoid jeopardy, to keep this important industry open, and to authorize the fisheries is a benefit. It's not not something that prompted the agency to avoid or sidestep any sort of necessary analysis or benefits for the industry.
Let me ask you about a statement at 45 of your brief. The relevant text, this is of 782. The relevant text says nothing about how an agency must handle uncertainties in the data. However, nor does it limit the sorts of conclusions agencies may draw when they face uncertainty. At 506 in the appendix opinion, it says, as the assumptions may be considered pessimistic, but given congressional guidance on implementation of the ESA, we need to give the benefit of the doubt to the species. So, and that elsewhere, that's 850, it's the agency describes that guidance as a directive. So the agency seems to be proceeding on the belief that it is compelled to do what it did. Well, or what you're saying it didn't do, give the benefit of the doubt. Although, in various places it says that, but it certainly seems to think that it's compelled by the statute at one point, and at another, that the statute doesn't give any binding view on this.
Correct, and I realize that there's some tension between saying, look at what the agency said here and look at what the agency did here. But when we're talking about using the best available data, the record shows that the agency did that. Our brief explains that it applied.
You made that point. I take that point.
I see the tension. Ultimately, the idea that an agency might proceed conservatively in the face of unclear data when it's producing an analysis under the Endangered Species Act is consistent with the Act. We would never agree that goal should trump any requirement to apply the best available data, and that's what the.
By the way, if the biological opinion were set aside, wouldn't the previous biological opinion just simply kick in and remain the reigning document?
I can only speculate, Your Honor, but because these are scientific analyses, I don't think that the prior one could spring back into force. It would need to be updated to ensure that it reflects the best available data. This brings me to one quick point I'll make, is that if the court is inclined to vacate, no party has requested vacater of the biop to date, and we'd like an opportunity to submit briefing. Also, keeping the biop, the opinion in place is important because it's something that the agency looks to when it grants permits to the fishery. And so setting aside this no jeopardy opinion, which has no harms currently, will produce harms. Both for the agency and for the regulated.
I'm sorry, you said the opinion is something you look to in doing what?
In granting permits for the fishery.
Which is ongoing.
Correct.
That sort of confirms Mr. Clement's point that BIOP has all of these other consequences besides arguably supporting phase one.
Well, the argument that I understand our opponents to make is that there are regulatory effects and harms that flow from the biological opinion. Our point is that the opinion exists as an analysis of the fisheries, and in some limited instances, it's used to ensure that the fisheries can continue to operate. And I'd be happy to submit additional briefing if the court.
If the previous biological opinion kicked in until such time as the current one could be updated, corrected, so on. That one found that there was no jeopardy, right, for the right whales and authorized lobster fishery under Section 7. So That would just be, if that's the, if that would legally kick in, that would be the status quo until such time as a new, now a new and improved opinion were.
I don't mean to resist the hypothetical. I'm simply, I don't have enough information to say whether it would in fact kick in this time.
Judge Rao, anything else? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. Is it Monsell?
Monsell.
Monsell, welcome.
Good morning. May it please the court, Kristen Monsell on behalf of intervener appellees. I'd just like to briefly address one issue, and that is why the court doesn't have jurisdiction over appellant's second claim challenging the conservation framework, as they haven't and can't shown they're injured by it and thus lack standing to challenge it. And that's because despite recognizing the critically endangered status of the North Atlantic right whale and the threat that the lobster fishery poses to the species, the agency didn't actually require any changes to the fishery in the framework itself. It has no current impact on the fishery. It simply lays out risk reduction targets for 1 to 2 future rulemakings for the fishery through 2030 and doesn't specify any particular measures. And in fact, the framework says expressly and repeatedly that there will be an evaluation period before each new phase to examine new information, that the targets are subject to revision as new information becomes available based on those 2 evaluation phases, and that further action may not be needed. And I would direct the court's attention specifically to A605 and A1078 in the record, where the agency says it will evaluate new information and, quote, evaluate whether further action in the federal fisheries is needed, and if so, at what level. So the claims you're hearing about how the framework imposes draconian measures in the briefing and the arguments today are just simply impossible to square with the framework.
Do you agree that there is a live controversy with respect to the final rule?
We haven't challenged plaintiffs or appellant standing with respect to claim one.
And insofar as that challenge is live, we can review aspects of the biological opinion to the extent we think they support or don't support the final regulation.
I think that's
okay. Thank you.
So they don't have standing based on standing to challenge the framework based on phase one. And that's for a couple of different reasons. One, as you've heard,
that's just the merits argument that the rule can be justified through the marine mammal statute as opposed to the ESA.
Right. The record demonstrates that the agency developed that rule under the Marine Mammal Protection Act to comply with separate statutory requirements.
Which is a contested question on the merits of their challenge to the
rule. Correct. Yes. And I think the framework itself at 1072 to 73 explains how that phase one rule was developed apart from the framework and elsewhere in the record at for example, 329, it explains that it was a separate process. And moreover, I think that their arguments against the framework aren't based on current harm from the rule itself, but speculation about future harms, about what might happen in the event the agency does issue these future rules and a risk.
The rule has
98%.
Rule has $10 to $20 million of compliance costs. That's going to give them standing.
Right. And we haven't challenged their standing to challenge the biological opinion and the analysis leading to the final rule, only their challenge with respect to claim 2 and
right. 3.
And that's because the framework's targets for future rulemakings have no current are explicitly subject to revision based on a new information. And there was also reference of the requirement to gather data or participate in team meetings, but those are requirements that are required under Section 118 and other provisions of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, not the framework itself. And furthermore, in the recent Appropriations Act, the Congress mandated that the agency continue to collect more data and file written reports with Congress once a year to show its progress towards developing this new final goal in 2020. So there are claims from injury for the framework. At this point are purely conjectural, not actual, and we ask that the court reject their second claim on that basis.
A trial? Judge Ginsburg? Thank you.
Thank you.
We gave you a pretty good workout the first time. You want to keep going?
I would like that, Your Honor. I'll try to be brief. And unless you want to take a recess first, but I'll go.
Why don't you sit down for a minute?
Okay.
Mr. Clement.
I just want to make a few points, quick points in rebuttal. I mean, first of all, I think it's worth underscoring that the argument that the final rule did not rely on the buyout is not just a merits argument, it is a forfeited merits argument. And this whole case proceeded on the assumption that all of this was intertwined. That's a very logical assumption. The conservation framework that's evaluated in the buyout includes the final rule. The final rule was issued after the buyout. Whether or not it expressly refers to it, it uses the same data and the same flawed data, which is why Judge Boasberg and all the parties, until the Appropriations Act and the government had an incentive to try to disentangle them, proceeded on the assumption that it was all one and the same. So that argument is merits argument and forth. One, just at the risk of being pedantic, to point out a Freudian slip on the government, when they came up here and talked about the statutory language, their statutory shorthand was the best available science. But the statutory language is the best available scientific and commercial data. And the Supreme Court unanimously in Bennett against Speer underscored that language was added to this particular provision after TVA Hill to impose a modicum of cost-benefit analysis into the system. So I think, although maybe it's a Freudian slip, I think it is an important distinction. And lastly, just to underscore the arm on the scale point. And just to go back to A814 and that chart and the reasoning of the agency, just to give you another illustration of this was not, as you said, a thumb, but an arm on the scale. If you look at the data in the chart and you keep in mind that the reason we're here is because of the unusual mortality event in 2017, the best available scientific data, if you ask me, is that in 2016, 2017, and 2018, every single documented entanglement was a Canadian one. It wasn't 80 to 20%. For those 3 years, it was 100% to zero. And yet, why was that data completely ignored? It was because using a different data set provides the benefit of the doubt of the species and a more conservative estimate of right whale entanglement. So right there, it's not just breaking the tie, it's completely disregarding a whole set of data based on that presumption, which impacted the entire analysis. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.